Even though they said they had 50 people sign up already.
Those are all online. They're online. They're all staying in.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Chuck Anders, and I am the facilitator of the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, and I'd like to welcome everyone to the 26th public meeting of the engagement panel since its inception in 2018. This meeting is going to be both an in-person and online meeting. We do have four panelists online in addition to the seven panelists that are here with us tonight. The agenda, the presentations, and the resource materials for this meeting you can be found on the panel's website at DiabloCanyonPanel.org. And folks online or even here can go there to get the resource materials that will be discussed here tonight. Before we begin the meeting, I want to turn this over to panel member Jerry Finn for our safety moment. Jerry?
Excuse me, may I please say something? My name is Jackie Fienti. I'm here as a court reporter to take everything down verbatim. I can hear the voices that are speaking, but if someone's speaking and they're not on Zoom, I won't know who they are, and I won't know how to put their speaker name in front of everything they say. I know you've done this before. I haven't been in this atmosphere before. I am very good, but I can't get people who I don't understand what their names are, or like you just introduced somebody and I didn't hear what you said and I don't know how it's spelled, so I won't get the spelling correctly unless there's a sheet or you just want to spell it out for me real quick. I'll stand back now, but thank you for letting me say a few things.
Thank you very much.
Now, whoever came on, there's reverberation going on your Francis Romero.
Yeah.
As soon as you came on, it was reverberating.
Thank you. Can you hear me now?
Who is speaking, please?
This is Chuck Anders, and I'd recommend
Chuck
that.
Anders, I can.
Thank you.
Okay, I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay.
But if you just start speaking, and you're not on the screen, your face doesn't come up, I'm not going to know it's you. There's several people doing that.
Okay.
There's no way a court reporter can get you unless you say your name every time you speak, and only one person can speak at a time, or it won't get on the record.
Okay, thank you. So it's a good reminder that before you speak, please say your name so that our court reporter knows who's talking. So Jerry Finn, and in the first time you speak, please spell your name for our court reporter.
And I'm just give you a few words on safety. To start with, OSHA, which was going to make everybody shiver, has declared that this month, September, is the month of preparation for activities, for making sure your safety plans and execution plans are up to date. Our Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Panel Commission, committee, also decided to have their meeting in September. They did it last week. They had 2 days, Wednesday and Thursday, fully loaded with reports and from each of the sections of Diablo Canyon. They got through with it late Thursday, and they came back with their conclusions, which were that the canyon had a very good year. All the problems that have been solved mostly. They had one surprise, which was that the cross-section and the entry into the harbor had been reduced to about one-half size because of the sand that had been accumulated over the previous 38 years. So they're in the process of issuing a contract to haul that sand away and deposit it in a maritime, I would say a dust heap, except it's at the bottom of the ocean, deposit the sand there. But I think they really should take a look down at Southern California, where all those beaches have been losing their sand, and maybe they could strike some kind of a deal. Instead of it's costing us money to pull that sand out, man, we could get paid back and make a few bucks. So other than that, things were very good for the facility last year, and the safety commission committee was pleased with it. So you all should be pleased with it. And from there, I have a few things that you might think about having to do for the coming thing. Rainy season's coming up, and so, God willing, and the drought ends, that makes the roads pretty slippery. So you should maybe think about slowing down or at least planning out if you could stop on there. The other thing is that when you're driving and you're loading your family or the kids in or neighbors, don't even start the motor up until everybody's got their seat belt fastened, and most particularly before you ever leave the curb. And other than that, check about, you should have a lane around, a cleared lane around your house in case, protect it from fire, make it a little more easy for the fire department. Along with that, you have the problems of trying to clean up, and you might be up on your ladder. Well, don't go climbing up on ladders all by yourself. Get somebody to just stand around and make sure you don't fall off. And when you're fooling around with the ladders, make sure when you carry them around, you don't have them sticking up in the air and get caught in some electric wires. And you could light up very well for us. The other thing to remember is, you know, your pets really need something done for them too, to make sure that they're safe in an emergency. So don't forget them in the long haul. And that's about, and flu season's coming up.
Great.
And COVID-19 is starting to grow again. So do what is necessary for you to hold it back. Vaccine, mushrooms, prayers, whatever it is. Do it so the rest of us can all kind of take it a little more easy. Thank you all.
Thank you, Jerry. And I want to thank the Sheriff's Office for being here, and also the Diablo Canyon Fire Department for being here to support the panel members and the public. Our next agenda item is Scott Lathrop. To welcome everyone and kick off the meeting.
Thank you, Chuck. Thank you. My name is Scott Lathrop. It's Lathrop for the recorder. It's my pleasure tonight on behalf of the panel to welcome everybody to this meeting online and in person. We believe we have some presentations that are very informative tonight, and we hope to generate a lot of discussions as we go forward. Before we jump into any of the presentations, I wanted to kind of go over our overall agenda to give you kind of the roadmap as far as what we're planning on doing this evening. The first part of the meeting tonight will be presentations by two panel members, giving you kind of the background of how we got here and what's in future for the Diablo Canyon lands. And then what we're going to do is hear from state entities, state agencies that are going to be playing a big part with the tribal lands issues as they go forward. And Once we, you just lost my agenda. as we go down the agenda, we will hear from PG&E, a little short update on decommissioning prior to taking a break. And then when we come back from the break, we will open that up to the overall public for comments and questions and go down that path. And then we'll kind of wrap up the overall night with additional opportunity to show or explain what we're gonna be looking at on our next board meeting, our next panel meeting. So with that, what I would like to do is go ahead and get started and we'll see if we can cue up the overheads here. Oops, let's go back one. My portion of the presentation is going to be covering essentially these three items. It was originally going to be primarily talking about land ownership and panel recommendations, but I thought it might be good just to kind of do a little recap as far as the panel in general, as far as the panel establishment, and then mission statement, and of course our overall vision that we have. So that's kind of like what I'm going to be covering as we go forward. I wanted to zero in on the establishment of the panel. A lot of people probably in the community are thinking, well, how did this come about? What is this all for? Well, I see it as one of the major items that the panel came together was simply the land. There was a lot of interest back in 2015, 2016, when there was a lot of discussion about decommissioning of the plant, what was going to happen with the lands. And so out of the process of the out of the CPUC process, the Nuclear Decommissioning Triennial proceeding, there was a directive that came out of that process that basically directed PG&E that they could not liquidate, could not sell, could not deal with the land unless there was a local community input to talk about what should be best for the land. And so that's one of the primary reasons. I know that PG&E would say there's other reasons why the engagement panel came together, but from my perspective, that's one of the major items. And so you can see that in May 24, 2018, that's when the panel was actually officially established with adoption of its charter. And we set off on a goal to essentially provide information or be the conduit between the community and PG&E and any of the regulators. And so that's kind of like how it began. And of course, one of the major things I wanted to point out for the panel's mission statement, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, but basically what it's saying is that we are acting as an information conduit between these different entities. We really have no authority to do anything. We do make some recommendations, but again, they are recommendations. It's an independent panel. We wanted to make sure that people understood that this is an independent panel. It's not governed by PG&E or anything else. It is something that we do stand alone on our own. So, out of that work in 2018 through roughly 2019, the panel that was established at that time did quite a bit of work putting together this vision document. And the subject matters reviewed in this vision document are over there to the right. And I highlighted the ones that we're going to be speaking about tonight. And of course, as we get into the conversation, public comments, we're hopefully you'll limit your comments to these two issues. This is what we're here for tonight, not to take any other kind of input. We want to make a good use of everyone's time as it relates to these items. So again, we'll be talking about those two items in red. The document that you see is online. Our panel has a website. You'll see it online. It's a fairly large document. You'll notice that it was originally adopted by us in 2018. This document has been sent to the CPUC. The county has it. Almost every regulator either has this or it can easily get this document. And we really do believe that this is the voice of the community. There's a lot of things in there that some may not agree with, maybe even on the panel, but we believe it's the voice of the community that we put forth, and that's essentially our charge. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and start with what's on the agenda, talking a little bit about the Diablo Canyon lands. Essentially, the Diablo Canyon lands are five tracts of land. No doubt, on each one of these tracts, there's several different legal parcels. But whenever we're talking in the community, it's essentially boiling down to these five areas. If you look to the north there, the yellow portion, that is considered the North Ranch properties. And what's interesting about the North Ranch properties is that the property is actually owned by the PG&E Utility Company. And that's an important distinction simply because the yellow is the one that has a primary, the tribal land transfer policy primarily covers that area. Now, there has been some discussions at the CPU level that other areas that are owned by PG&E's subsidiary would have to have some consideration for the tribal land transfer policy. But officially, it's only the yellow area that the tribal land transfer policy comes into play. You'll see that there's parcel P. That's kind of that orangey colored or red color in the middle. That is essentially the site of the Diablo Canyon Power Plant, and we have some slides later on that will drill down into that area. You can see it a little bit better. We have the South Ranch. That area is particularly important to tribal groups because we know of a village site that has been identified on that location. Actually, have won award for that site, restoration kind of award. And then we have Wild Cherry Canyon. And you probably have heard a lot about Wild Cherry Canyon in the news because there is this still this little legal battle happening. And that is kind of going down its own path. And we would all hope that that would be resolved sooner than not. So that kind of gives you the big picture as far as the parcels. You may ask, well, what's the green around it? Essentially, those are owned by state agencies. You can see Montana de Oral State Park. And so that kind of gives you the lay of those lands. I have to say it's beautiful, pristine land. One of the benefits of having the power plant there is that this land has been protected because of the limited access to the overall area. It's a beautiful place. So let's move on and go to the next section of my presentation, primarily zeroing in on our vision for that overall land. And if you go to our document, our vision document, it starts on page 105. You can see it's a subsection C, Diablo Canyon Land Recommendations. The overall document actually has three parts. It has kind of like our vision and some goals, but then I only zeroed in on the recommendations, and the items that I have listed on the bullet points here are a summary of each one of those items. If you went to the document, you'd see there is a lot more words as far as trying to kind of define what we're trying to do, but I think this captures the message of what we're trying to do. First of all, when we look at Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, this is something that was high on everybody's list, and that was soon as the document was submitted to the CPUC, that PG&E actually met their commitment of having that public engagement. And so this is why this bullet reads, PG&E is to seek permission from CPUC to proceed with conservation discussions with conservation entities. And so we were hoping back when this was originally presented that would free up PG&E to have discussions with conservation entities to try to, put the land into conservation sooner than even decommissioning at that time. If we're taking a look at land stewardship, there are some bullet points there. PG&E to ensure land management access plan for Diablo Canyon lands included in any land transfer. So the thinking was that would be a condition of sale, that before someone could purchase it or transfer it, they would have some conditions on the land. Looking at bullet number two, PG&E to share all existing information, biological, geological, archaeological data for future conservation. The idea there was, you know, why recreate the wheel? There's information there. It should be passed on to whoever may be the new owner of that, you know, conservation group. And then PG&E to record pending deed restriction of the 1,200 acres near Point San Luis Obispo, Point San Luis. There was an opportunity several years back, I guess it was the steam generator, I think that's what the project was, where there was a condition that PG&E was going to put this deed restriction on some properties, and I'm not really sure, maybe PG&E can clarify, but I believe that process is pretty well completed, or real close to being completed, if not. Yeah, so that's, you know, I should have put that one in red and said that one's done, right? But then moving on, continuing with other recommendations for the land, now we got into a subtitle or a subcategory of land transfer and use. Now this is, you know, dear to my heart since I'm involved and represent the native groups, transfer of Diablo Canyon lands to a governmental, and I'll underline two times Native American group or land conservation entity. And so as far as the vision of the panel, as far as how they would see ownership of land in the future, PG&E to publicly announce the intent to collaborate with conservation entities, that would be something fantastic to see sooner than not. PG&E, Eureka Energy. I should have addressed it in the lands. The South Ranch and Cherry Canyon and also Parcel P, the ownership is by Eureka Energy, which is a subsidiary of PG&E Corporate. So here we're saying reinstate negotiations with interested conservation entities of these three different properties. Begin design and development of two multi-use trails, coastal and inland. PG&E to consider transfer of land north of Harbor Terrace, Port San Luis Obispo Harbor, to essentially for the use of the district there for storage. That was something that came up in the discussions then. Going to the next slide, kind of finishing up with the overall recommendations of the surrounding lands. Cultural heritage, ensure the protection and preservation of sacred Native American sites. Provide land cultural heritage educational opportunities. Land transfer, I love this one, land transfer to Native American tribe, including a conservation easement, allowing limited land development. And then Native Americans and PG&E explore ways that land conservation, managed public access, and Native American-led land stewardship can be achieved. So those were the recommendations in those different categories that came from the vision document or came from the panel. I probably should have also addressed that the vision document, I would say, is a living document, meaning it is, you know, we do revise it as we gain more and more information and more input from the community. In fact, if you look at the cover, you'll see that it was revised several times since 2018. So with that, I want to move on to the next section, and that is repurposing of Diablo Canyon facilities. That's right there in the land. But most of the recommendations kind of are facility specific, but I'm going to go through them anyway. Existing facilities, PG&E need to repurpose as many buildings as viable. The thinking there is you have an asset, why just tear it up? Why blow it up or whatever? Why not try to figure out a repurpose of that? It would also save dollars in the decommissioning process. PG&E, in conjunction with the appropriate parties, determine allowable uses. In other words, try to figure out what's best uses and what would the county allow to happen out there. That would be the idea of kind of creating the marketability of those of the property for any future tenant, buyer of the property. PG&E to develop a process for receiving repurposing proposals as soon as appropriate. That process has been also done. I think you can find that on the PG&E's website, that if you're interested in any of those assets, there's a process that you can go through. New construction or infill of Parcel P, it seemed to make some sense that if you have vacant parking lots and things of that nature, there may be opportunities to kind of expand on the overall campus for, I believe in one of our presentations, we're talking about clean energy or clean innovation kind of program. Parcel P, undeveloped land to be conserved as soon as possible. If you take a look at the slide, you can see that a majority of the land has no structures on them. And so it seemed to make a lot of sense to the panel that why put structures there? Why not fold that into the overall conservation plan? So that's the thinking there. Future land use, restrict traffic through surrounding communities. We had a lot of discussion from the Avila Beach community about truck traffic and you name it. And so when you think about expanding a site like that, you know, you're going to increase trips. So that was an item that was addressed for the repurposing. And then there was another item as far as evaluate maintaining the existence or desal plant. I guess last year, year before, you know, everybody was worried about water. Now we had a lot of water, so, you know, it kind of comes and goes. But that was something that was said it would probably be appropriate to take a look at that. Moving on to the marina, that was kind of like a special area of Parcel P. Basically retain the breakwater, associated harbor, and explore repurposing opportunities. That, to the, I want to say the majority of the panel seemed to make a lot of sense. There's a lot of destruction and a lot of cost of removing that overall breakwater, and it just didn't seem to make a lot of sense. And so that's why you see that as a recommendation. Recommend that PG&E require management of the harbor to be accomplished in a manner to preserve the natural habitat and allow for long-term maintenance, create safe harbor for different boaters. And then C, PG&E continue to monitor and study the harbor throughout the decommissioning process to assure the sensitive marine habitat is preserved and radiological contamination complies with regulatory levels. And so those are the recommendations for that. But there's one last that we want to talk about, and that is kind of specific uses. Most of you are maybe not have visited the visitor center for Diablo Canyon. That is kind of like hooked at the hip with the plant and the land. So there was some discussion about repurposing and the use of that facility. And then from the community, primarily from, I want to say, the economic development nonprofit in the area, there was a lot of working of recommendations on what to do with the existing plant site. So there are some specific uses. We said public, private collaboration, research and development facility, something similar like the national labs could be something that could go out there. Plant site facility, wildlife habitat center, recreational use. There's a series of things there that we highlighted that could be used for. Long-term lease or purchase. I like this one again. Long-term lease or purchase with favorable terms to Native American tribes, use of existing facilities. And then the Ontario Road facility, that's the education center, to highlight local history, Native American culture, energy, education, and natural history. Really become kind of a educational center. And then Ontario Road facility to be maintained for shuttle or bus service to Diablo Canyon lands, kind of like. So that kind of wraps up my portion of the overall presentation. I know that I'm going to hand this off to Kara, who is going to go over kind of some of the recent things that are happening.
Pass it on. Please remember to state your name and spell your name for the first time that you speak.
Hi, everybody. My name is Kara Woodruff, Woodruff, and I'm hoping today to take a few minutes to talk about the history of conservation and other activities on the lands, what's happening today, what's happening in the near future, and what we still need to do to really achieve our goals out there on the land. So can we load the presentation up, please? Yeah. Great. Okay, on this first slide, there is quite a long history of conservation and other efforts pertaining to the Diablo Canyon lands. And it started back in 2000. The San Luis Obispo County voters were asked to consider whether they wanted to see the land surrounding the plant, the 12,000 acres, conserved after Diablo closes. And the San Luis Obispo County voters overwhelmingly said yes, conservation was their future, and that passed by 75% of the voters of San Luis County. Years later, the strategic vision was adopted by the panel, and Scott went into some detail about that. In 2021, a group called the Friends of the Diablo Canyon Lands formed, and that was 40 or more people and organizations that put together the conservation framework. And if you're interested in that, you could find it at diablocanyonlands.org. And then the next year, a partnership proposal was put together by an alliance of groups, and that you can find at www.yttnorthernchumashtribe.com. And then finally this year, the California Natural Resources Agency put together a Diablo Canyon Land Conservation and Economic Development Plan. And LaQuinn Nguyen from the Natural Resources Agency is here tonight, and she'll tell you all about that shortly. But what I think is interesting, these five plans had considerable agreement and overlapping. They all shared these common elements. All of them advocated for the conservation of all 12,000-acre Diablo Canyon lands. All of them advocated for sustainable public access, including trails like a coastal trail and interior trails. All of them also envisioned future ownership of the land transferring away from PG&E to public, nonprofit, or tribal entities. And all of them were either silent on or advocated for repurposing and other economic and green development on the 600 acre parcel P. And that's pretty extraordinary when you think about it. Over these last 23 years, the major plans that have been adopted are essentially saying the same thing. And it's quite extraordinary that we're all on the same page in this community. So we've already had some conservation successes, and there are three listed here. So you may recall back in 1993, the Pecho Coast Trail was established, and this is a guided 3.75-mile or 9-mile round-trip hike with a trailhead at Port San Luis. If you're interested in taking this trail, it's just absolutely stunning, just beautiful. Just simply Google Pecho Coast Trail, and you'll see the directions on how to take advantage of this. This trail was established by the Coastal Commission under a permit condition for PG&E's training and simulator building. And then in 2007, a second public access trail was established. It's a 6.6-mile round-trip hike that you access through Montana de Oro park called the Point Bouchon Trail. It's open Thursdays. And also, if you wanted to see that trail, it's very easy to get to. Just simply Google Point Bouchon Trail and you'll get all the details. This was also established by the Coastal Commission pursuant to a permit condition for PG&E's ISFC, which is their dry cask interim storage facility on site. And all of these three changes that were made to advance this conservation vision are in perpetuity. So those are complete. Very exciting. Right now, we have a couple of activities going on that will take us even closer to conservation and public access and tribal ownership and state ownership of the Diablo Canyon lands. The first is a topic that came up at the last meeting of the engagement panel. As you recall, the San Luis Obispo County Planning Department just issued a draft EIR for the decommissioning of the plant. And as a permit condition for Diablo Canyon's decommissioning, PG&E is required to record an irrevocable offer to dedicate a public access easement to create a Diablo Lands connector trail that would stretch across the Diablo Canyon lands. The permit conditions also would require PG&E to locate the trail, to avoid sensitive resources, develop a trails access plan, permit and construct the trails, and ensure the implementation and management of the trail program in perpetuity. So this draft document's been out a number of weeks now. The comments are due on September 25th, so if you care to weigh in on this permit condition or otherwise, check out that website by the San Luis Obispo County Planning Department. The other activity that's pending on conservation will also be the subject of presentations this evening. But thanks to a budget allocation that was really advanced by Assemblymember Addis and Senator Laird, $10 million were set aside to move us further down the conservation and public access trail. So the first $5 million will go to the State Coastal Conservancy for the purpose of developing a conservation easement across all 12,000 acres to map future coastal and interior trail locations, to conduct public and tribal outreach efforts, and to undertake pre-acquisition tasks on Wild Cherry Canyon prior to its transfer to a state agency. This is item 8 on the agenda tonight, and Trish Chapman from the State Coastal Conservancy is here, and she'll make a presentation on that. And then there's a second $5 million, which has been allocated to GoBiz to support planning, reuse, and redevelopment of the 600-acre Parcel P, the plant site. And that's item 9 on tonight's agenda. And before going on to the next slide, I just wanted to mention, if you take a look at the tasks assigned to the State Coastal Conservancy with their $5 million, there is significant overlap between the duties outlined in that allocation with the permit condition that's contained in the draft EIR. And so, in other words, the EIR is saying you have to do PG&E a fair amount of trail work, and the State Coastal Conservancy grant also has to do a fair amount of trail work. So there is some redundancy there that I think will have to be addressed in the future. So if everything that is pending goes through fruition, there are still a number of steps that still have to be taken to satisfy the vision that was articulated in those 5 plans that have been developed over the last couple decades. And so the first one is actually recording the conservation easement. The State Coastal Conservancy grant would prepare a draft easement, but it actually would have to be recorded on the land. We'd also have to transfer South and North Ranch, and I think the consensus is largely that it end up in tribal ownership. Then we'd have to transfer Wild Cherry Canyon to state ownership. That's a little complicated by some petty litigation, but hopefully we get through that. And then finally, we would need to promote local jobs in our regional economy with green economic development on Parcel P. So in wrapping up, how will we get there? How will we achieve these last steps? Well, I can think of 3 ways right off the bat. First of all, with this environmental impact report, the permit condition that has been articulated by the county, which would create some new trail locations, this will implement some of this vision. And in fact, maybe because there is overlap of interest between what PG&E is required to do and what the State Coastal Conservancy might do, it may be that some of the tasks that PG&E will be tasked to do will already be done by the time they get to that. And maybe there's some room for the draft EIR to ask more of PG&E, like to set aside some lands for a conservation easement. I know that some people have already argued that on the record. Secondly, when PG&E applies for an extension of their license to operate Diablo at the end of this year, that application will be subject to Coastal Commission review under the Coastal Zone Management Act, and they very well could impose conditions on granting that consistency review, much like they impose conditions on prior PG&E permits. And then finally, in SB 846, which was passed last year, which is the Diablo extension bill, $150 million were to allocated at that time for conservation and economic development. So we do have some assets that could be available to complete this conservation vision. So I think there's great hope for the future. If we all are serious about protecting this land and ensuring public access, there's never been a more important time to get involved and advocate for that. We've gotten so far now because of the tremendous and consistent public support for conservation and public access, and I think that's how we're going to end up in a position where we can see all lands protected, respecting the tribal's ownership and legacy of the Native Americans that lived here long ago and still do, and also to ensure that we all have public access to these lands. And with that, I want to move on to the next part of our agenda, which is from the Natural Resources Agency.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara. The next item on the agenda is a discussion of requirements for land conservation and economic development plan. And we're very pleased to have with us tonight LaQuinn Nguyen, who is the Deputy Secretary for Energy of the State Natural Resources Agency. So thank you. Go ahead, Quinn. You have to push the red button there.
Yeah, thank you. Good evening, everybody. My name is LaQuinn Nguyen. That's N-G-U-Y-E-N. So thank you for inviting me to speak in front of you and present our conservation and economic development plan. So as Chuck said, I'm the Deputy Secretary for Energy at the California Natural Resources Agency, and tonight I'll be providing you with a brief presentation on the report that CNRA submitted to the legislature in May of this year regarding land conservation and economic development of the land surrounding Diablo Canyon. So just a quick refresher on why we did this report. Senate Bill 846 required CNRA, in consultation with the Labor, Workforce, and Development Agency, GoBiz, the Coastal Commission, the State Lands Commission, the State Water Resources Control Board, and the Public Utilities Commission, to develop a plan that supports environmental enhancements and access to the Diablo Canyon power plant lands, as well as economic development of those lands in coordination or in a manner that was consistent with existing decommissioning efforts. So
Excuse me, may I please ask you to slow down a little bit when you're reading, because when you read so fast, it becomes a little bit garbled, and it's hard for the court reporter to get every single stroke consistently. Just a little bit. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Okay, so to inform this report, we reviewed past and present planning, visioning, and public engagement efforts, as well as existing documents, including this panel's strategic vision. We also visited the area in January and February of this year to meet with stakeholders, including federal, state, and local electeds, California Native American tribes, and environmental groups. And then at the end of our visit in February, we held a public listening session to hear from the public on their concerns as well as their interests related to the future use of the Diablo Canyon lands. And so what we have on this slide are the main themes of the comments that we heard. So we heard return of Diablo Canyon lands to the YTT, durable environmental conservation of Diablo Canyon lands, stewardship of the Diablo Canyon lands by public entity, continued managed public access, expansion of the California Coastal Trail via a carefully placed extension, reuse of Parcel P for clean energy innovation to support economic development, avoiding the cost of implementing the plan from carrying over to the county, and continued engagement with the county and community. So based on what we heard, we put together this report that identified guiding values to be considered in any decision-making process around the future use of the Diablo Canyon lands. And so here on this slide are those guiding values. And while they're listed numbered 1 through 5, like, this is not a ranked order priority. We consider all of these values to be equally important. So this reflects the broad sentiment that we heard from both the public and during conversations with stakeholders. So I'll go through each of them one at a time and then provide a little bit more detail on how we came up with that value. So the first value is to foster the robust conservation of environmental and cultural resources while enabling appropriate public access. So we heard very clearly the importance of conserving environmental and cultural resources at the Diablo Canyon lands while also protecting existing public access. We also heard a desire to expand public access, but managed public access while also still protecting the environmental and cultural resources. There was also support expressed for a strong conservation easement or some other appropriate legal instrument that would ensure conservation of these resources and values. And by values, I mean also making sure that the conservation easement or whatever legal instrument that would be developed in consultation and with conversations with other entities, external stakeholders. So it would be other, you know, local electeds, Native American tribes, NGOs, and others. And then also we heard that this needed to be in perpetuity and that any managed access should also be included within that conservation easement. And so the second guiding value is to support transfer of ownership to of North Ranch and South Ranch to California Native American tribes. And tribal ownership and stewardship was a critical component of future land use during the conversations that we had. And California policy supports, where possible, returning ancestral lands to tribal stewardship. The third guiding value is exploring expanding existing managed public access of Diablo Canyon lands. So in California, we have a long-standing goal to enhance access to the California coast for all Californians. And many groups and leaders emphasize the importance of maintaining and hopefully expanding recreational access to the Diablo Canyon lands. And so because there are many critical cultural and environmental resources on these lands, it's really important that we think coastal access should be thoughtfully developed as well as managed. So we heard a desire for more expansive recreation at Wild Cherry Canyon, an interior trail connecting Wild Cherry Canyon and Montana de Oro through the Irish Hills, and a carefully placed extension of the California Coastal Trail connecting the Point Bouchon Trail to the Pecho Coast Trail. The fourth value is to enable reuse of Parcel P for research and economic activity, including a clean tech incubator while protecting cultural, environmental, and marine resources on the site. As noted earlier, Parcel P is already industrialized and has existing infrastructure. So we, from our conversations, we saw this as an opportunity to reuse it to replace some of those jobs that will be lost during the decommissioning of the power plant with new jobs. So there was broad support for reusing Parcel P to establish the Central Coast as a key region for clean energy development. And during the conversations, we also realized that depending on future scope of that reuse, there could also be co-use, meaning potentially you could have activities on Parcel P while the plant was still operating or while it was being decommissioned. And then the fifth value is to explore transfer of ownership of Wild Cherry Canyon to state parks. So state parks is the only public land manager in the vicinity of Diablo Canyon. They already manage Montana de Oro State Park, as well as Avila State Beach. And so we heard interest from regional stakeholders in transferring ownership of Wild Cherry Canyon to state parks for helping to expand recreational opportunities there, as well as making sure it's maintained. Some things that we also mentioned and discussed was making sure that there was a tribal and conservation easement on those Wild Cherry Canyon parcels to ensure that tribes also have access to Wild Cherry Canyon. So that was my very quick, as the quote reporter noted, very quick run through of our guiding values. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
It's an opportunity for the panel to ask questions or make any comments. And if any of the panel members that are participating online have a question, please raise your hand.
I just had a quick comment. LaQuinn, could you tell people how they would get access to the report, how they could read it for themselves?
Yes. So it's actually on the last slide of my presentation, which I didn't click to, but on the resources website. So it's resources.ca.gov. Oops, here you go. /initiatives/transitioning to clean energy. And there will be a tab for SB 846, and the report can be found there.
I had a question. There was discussion about limited development by the YTT tribe, and I was wondering if there's been any detailed discussion about what that development might involve. You know, are we ever going to have a 20-story casino on Parcel P, or would anything like that happen? I would think it'd be great if they could have community development of some kind, since they, you know, occupied those lands at some time. But, you know, what? How limited is limited? Do you have any idea about that?
So in our conversations and in this document, we didn't envision specific, like, what projects specifically should happen or not happen. Parcel P specifically, we thought something related to economic development. A lot of the conversation was related to some sort of clean tech incubator or hub to support, you know, clean energy. So, for example, like offshore wind was suggested. So for, again, because it's already an industrialized site, we thought that would be a great opportunity, and you have the breakwater. We were thinking, again, this clean energy or clean tech incubator. In terms of development of the other areas of the Diablo Canyon lands, you know, in terms of like what development should happen there, I think there was strong support for some sort of conservation easements to protect the lands as is. When we thought about you know, expanding public access. It was really about recreational opportunities, so expanding the public, the trails, and making sure they were managed access as well, so that, again, it's not just unfettered access that could potentially damage, like, the resources. But, you know, when we were, the values that we were thinking of were, again, just related to expanding the trails and recreational opportunities.
So is the development of Parcel P being limited specifically to clean energy development, you know, maintaining the grid infrastructure that's there, yeah, and making use of that for offshore wind and other potential? I see you wanting to talk, so I'd be happy to have you jump in on this, Scott.
So the report itself, it doesn't say what needs to happen at that, at Parcel P, or what should happen. All these are just guiding values for when you, when there's future decision making related to what happens with those parcels. You know, our, what we're proposing is, you know, what should be thought of there, something that encourages economic development of that area, because there's already the infrastructure there,
yeah,
because of that unique site. You know, it would be optimal for it to be a clean tech incubator or some sort of clean innovation park, but we don't look at limitations for what could be there.
So potentially some of the existing office buildings could be turned into hotels, or would they only be commercial, like incubator type?
If future uses? Decision makers were to decide that they, yeah, wanted hotels to be there, they,
okay,
could. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Will, Will Almas has a question online, okay, and then Linda, and then Patrick. Will?
Will Almas, and you saw that ALMAS. Mine is more of a comment than a question, but I would encourage California Natural Resources to consult with the various tribal entities during the early stages of planning and determine the appropriate tribal entities to proceed with planning and ultimately land transfer, to involve all of the different entities that may claim a portion of the area or cultural heritage in that area would be an almost impossible job going through a planning process and then into a land negotiation. I know that they're more than eight, and I think it's far more than eight, and more like in the teens, of tribal entities that do have expressed interest. So that, I hope that can be done, and that the my comment can be considered when you get into that planning process with the $5 million that are allocated for it. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Linda, Patrick, and then Kara.
Thanks for your presentation. Two things I'd like to say. You just said future decision makers could decide, yes, that there can be hotels there or a kind of a commercial development on Parcel P. And I'm wondering, number one, who those future decision makers might be. And then number two, I want to disagree with what Bill Almas said about the, I think he just said that he thinks that the Department of Natural Resources should decide, like, a particular entity to, of a tribal entity to, take ownership of the land. I don't think that's realistic. I think it would be, I don't think that's the job of, I think that has to be negotiated internally among the different tribal entities, and that they should make that decision. That's all. I think that. Oh, and I wanted to spell my name. I'm sorry, I forgot to do it. S-E-E-L-E-Y. Thank you.
This is LeQuin, Nguyen, N-G-U-Y-E-N. If I could just respond to your two comments in reverse order, so I'll start with the second one. So the Resources Agency, that $5 million to support the conservation of the Diablo Canyon lands, that was given to us in the budget, but we were given the ability to transfer that to the Coastal Conservancy to facilitate that work. So I don't want to steal Trish's thunder, and you'll hear from her about what that work will entail. But you know, that $5 million, I think what we're anticipating is that will actually just go to supporting, looking at like what is feasible in terms of conservation of that land. And so this will be more more studies, fact finding. There will be no actual decisions made out of it in terms of this is what. You know, the exact like order of conservation will be. This will just be information to feed into that process. In terms of who the decision makers are for the future reuse of Parcel P, you know, that is a good question. I can imagine it will be the legislature directing us what to do with Parcel P. And again, when I said that, you know, theoretically a hotel could be at Parcel P, I didn't mean a hotel would be there. What I was saying is just that our document is guiding values. So it's information for people to consider as they're deciding what to do on that land. So again, it's based off of the years of existing efforts and documents that have already happened within the community. It's based on stakeholder feedback and public input. So really meant to just synthesize, all the information that's out there and provide in just a nice little package for somebody who, again, is proceeding with decision making to take into account.
Thank you. And I just need to remind everybody, you only need to spell your name the first time, because there's a video record of this also. And then the court reporter can look at the video and see who's speaking. So, Patrick, you have a question.
Yes. Hi. Thank you. This is Patrick Lemieux, L-E-M-I-E-U-X. So I want to echo Bruce's concern, too. When I was hearing all this, I also thought of the immense pressure there must be for hotel developments on that site down the line. And I just hope the process continues to be transparent as we move forward, and that we hear both within the panel and in the community what the stakeholders are and what they're proposing. But on Parcel P, there really is an elephant there in the decommissioning process that in my understanding has not been resolved, and that's the ISFC. And to correcting Kara from her previous comment, there's two I's in ISFC, and neither one of them stands for interim. It's conceivable that the dry casks can constitute a permanent repository of spent nuclear fuel, because there is no other. So how do all these plans jive with the possibility that these casks are there for a long, long, long time?
So I think it really depends upon like what the plans are for reuse of the site. And I know there's a lot of community input and guidance and thoughts on what should be done at that plant. I think they're all considering, if that spent nuclear fuel is there indefinitely or for a short amount of time. What we found out through in our conversation, though, is that there are limited activities that could take place on Parcel P that could happen while that plant is there, while you have the spent nuclear fuel there. But that's a good question in terms of long-term, what can you actually do on that site? Mm-hmm. And I think PG&E would be responsible for that nuclear fuel as long as it's there, and I think any future development of Parcel P would probably have to be done in consultation with PG&E, so they could provide insight as to, security or other limitations that they have around use of that site, as long as that spent nuclear fuel is there.
Okay, Kara, do you have a question? Anyone else? Go ahead, Will.
I just wanted to clarify what I said, my comments earlier. I said tribal entity or entities. Now, that my idea there is that you can't bring 12 or 15 different entities into a room and actually have meaningful discussion on planning of an area. And that assumes that tribal entities will be brought in during that planning effort and not after it's all done. So, and present it as a plan. So I wanted I wasn't necessarily specifying one entity, but there's got to be a way of narrowing it down to less than those that are on the list for potential consultation. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Bruce.
Bruce Severance, S-E-V-E-R-A-N-C-E. I did not spell it the first time. Scott, in one of his bullet points, talked about monitoring radiological contamination in the marine environment in the harbor there. And I had asked somebody else from the state offline as to whether or not a specific state agency is part of the planning that would provide another set of, regulatory overlay on the monitoring of any kind of radiological contamination that may exist at the site. There is a historic site assessment that I believe was completed in 2017 by Black and Veatch, and in that there is a interesting discussion of where radiological contamination could accumulate in different places in sump pumps, et cetera, at the facility, how it might run off into the creek bed, et cetera. And then just about every section says, but we don't have data on that. And so my concern is that we may not have sufficient data at this time that would normally be required of a nuclear power plant, at least the historic site assessment. To me, it looked like there's probably 18 sections of it that just says there are gaps in the data. We don't really know. So it seems to me that a lot more study should be performed, and probably by a regulatory agency or somebody that's got oversight from a regulatory agency to verify exactly what the conditions are on site at this time, because that report is very thin on information.
Yeah, that's a great point, and I'm not sure where that work is happening. I wish I had additional state colleagues here. So I know Water Board, I can ask them. I mean, they also have a regulatory role in any future permitting, so maybe this is something they could do. I also saw a Coastal Commission colleague in the room, and they also have a permitting role, so it's something I could bring to them. And then also State Lands Commission, they also have a permitting role as well for any like future reuse that may involve Parcel P. So I think those are questions that I'll bring to them.
Thank you. And it seems that kind of regulatory framework needs to be a condition of approval of whatever repurposing plan is put in place. And I personally love the idea of redevelopment for an incubator, clean tech applications, onshoring power cables for offshore wind at that location. All of that makes sense to me, and I very, very wholeheartedly supportive of the economic development potential of the site. And I don't think that every building should be disassembled and hauled away in a truck. It doesn't make sense to me. So I think that there is need for a coherent plan so that, there's something of a hodgepodge of buildings and parking lots out there right now. It's not necessarily conducive to whatever the future uses might be. And we should probably be collaborating with Cal Poly and other institutions like that to develop that plan more thoroughly than we currently, we're talking about it in broad brushstrokes right now. It'd be great if, I'm a contractor, so I like a set of plans, where you can really see what we're potentially looking at,
Okay, thank you, Bruce. There's no further comments or questions. Thank you, LeQuinn, for traveling down here and participating in our meeting.
Yeah, thank you.
Our next speaker is Trish Chapman. Trish is the Central Coast Manager for the State Coastal Conservancy, and she is going to speak on the State Coastal Conservancy's role and the recent $5 million appropriation for conservation of Diablo Canyon lands. Trish?
Thank you. Trish Chapman, C-H-A-P-M-A-N. And again, I am the Coastal Conservancy's Central Coast Manager, and also here tonight is our Executive Officer, Amy Hutzel. First, I just want to say that I'm really excited to be here tonight. It's been a really long-held dream at the Conservancy to see the lands around Diablo Canyon Plant saved for conservation and public access. And now to have the goal of tribal ownership and management, it's really a once-in-a-lifetime project to be a part of, and we're very excited and honored to have a role in it. As has already been mentioned, this year's state budget includes $5 million to support the development of conservation easements on the lands surrounding the plant. And this money is the result of lots of time and energy that this community, your community, to create the vision of what you'd like to see when the plant closes. The Conservancy's goal with the $5 million is to work with all of you to help achieve that shared vision for the Diablo lands. A portion of the funds will be specifically for community engagement and participating in the planning, and this will include working extensively with the tribes. The Conservancy has a long history of working in and engaging with communities through our land conservation and public access grant programs, and we welcome and encourage everyone to be involved. The purpose of the conservation easements will be to ensure the long-term conservation of the lands, but it's also to identify the location of possible future trails or other limited development. And to develop those easements, we'll need a thorough understanding of the resources on the lands so that sensitive resources can be protected from the impacts of development like trails. To achieve this, we'll need assessments of the natural habitats, cultural and tribal resources, geologic conditions, and perhaps others. As has already been discussed, we know that there are multiple regulatory processes underway related to extending the use of the power plant and its eventual decommissioning. We've begun coordinating with the involved state and local agencies to make sure that the state's $5 million doesn't duplicate or subsidize any mitigation that PG&E is required to do as part of these processes. So I don't know that it was clear that the $5 million wasn't actually appropriated to us. It was appropriated to the Natural Resources Agency. So among our next steps, the first one is to actually get the money to our agency. We're hoping this will be done by late fall, but this is in the world of the Department of Finance, and it's out of our hands. Our next task will be to develop a draft scope of work, or at least a draft scope of work for initial tasks, and to bring on a consultant team to help us with the effort. And we will be coordinating with the Coastal Commission, the county, and other agencies on the work that PG&E will be required to do and the pieces that we should pick up. Definitely, community engagement will be a part of what conservancy funding goes towards, but other things may be done by PG&E. For example, they may be responsible for some of the needed technical studies that I just mentioned. And it's all very much in the early stages of being worked out, what we will spend the $5 million on, what PG&E will be required to do. Our lead for this, we have just one slide, but will be Tim Duff, who's been our long-time project lead for San Luis Obispo County, and he's also our statewide lead for the California Coastal Trail. And I think a slide will come up with both his contact information and mine. He's on vacation this week, or he absolutely would have been here today. Please feel free to reach out to either of us if you have questions about the Conservancy's work on the project. And just in closing, I want to express my appreciation and admiration for all the work that you all have done in developing and promoting this vision for the Diablo Lands. And again, to just say we're super honored to be a part of achieving it. That was what I had prepared to say. And I do, before there's more questions, I kind of want to address the question that came up from the panelist online about tribal consultation. And so as a state agency, we will absolutely consult with any tribe on the Native American Heritage Commission list of tribes recognized by the state of California that is interested in discussing the project. So we absolutely can consult and will consult with all of them. In our ideal world, I also agree that the best thing would be if the tribes together could jointly have a recommendation on what happens, and we will look to facilitate that with outside non-government facilitation. And if that kind of agreement is not possible, we'll address that when it, you know, if we come to that point, and see how we can best serve as many desires of the tribal community as possible.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Does the panel have any questions? Kara?
Thank you, Trish. I'm the district director for Senator Laird, and the reason I mention that is that Senator Laird serves on the board of the State Coastal Conservancy, and generally those meetings occur at a time where he's not able to attend, and I'm usually there on his behalf. And so I've been attending, I think, all the meetings for the last 3 years of your agency, and I could not be happier about your agency, your group getting this money, because I have been so incredibly impressed by the great projects that you fund, by your ability to handle public processes and to get the communities engaged in the projects that you present. And the projects, even your project selection is just excellent. The projects you pick not only have biodiversity as a major element, but you're always thinking about climate change and climate resilience and rising sea waters and working with tribal entities. So I just think you're perfectly suited for this task, and I'm just thrilled about it, and I'm glad you're going to be spending more time in town. And you mentioned that Tim Duff is going to be the lead. That's also really great news, although you two would also be excellent.
We'll be involved, for sure.
I know you will be. But Tim Duff, for all of you who don't know his name, he's been working on the Central Coast in San Luis Obispo County in particular for a couple decades now. And pretty much every large conservation project, including Hearst Ranch, Tim Duff had a huge part in. So he's no stranger to the area. I just think you have a great team, and I'm just glad you'll be doing this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kara. Any other comments from the panel or the panel members online?
I have a question. Linda. This Linda Seeley question. What's the difference? I mean, like, the Coastal Conservancy and then the California,
the Natural Resources Agency?
The Natural Resources Agency. What's the difference? I mean, what do you do that they don't do and vice versa?
Yeah, so the Natural Resources Agency is the umbrella agency or parent agency of multiple state agencies that deal with natural resources. So we're one of the agencies that are kind of under them. And so they look at the whole state, the whole gamut of natural resources. Our focus is really on the coast. And we're a non-regulatory agency, so we provide funding and technical assistance to communities to do things to protect and restore their coasts and increase public access and prepare for climate change, all of the above.
I'll just add, that's a great question, and there's a lot of confusion about the Coastal Conservancy versus the Coastal Commission, so maybe you can describe the differences there, too.
Absolutely. We've both agencies eventually were a result of the Coastal Act. But the Coastal Commission is a regulatory agency, and then, as I said, we are not. And the easiest way to describe it is we have similar big picture goals, and they're the stick and we're the carrot. So.
Any other comments or questions? Great. Well, thank you very much, Trish.
All right. Thank you all.
Our next speaker is going to speak on the Diablo Canyon Parcel P economic development. And Kaina Pera is online with us. And he is Senior Advisor for Business Development with the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, otherwise known as GoBiz. Kaina, are you on the line?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Okay. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Kaina Pereira, spelled on the screen, but P-E-R-E-I-R-A. And I'm privileged to be here to talk about GoBiz's role in relation to a $5 million appropriation that is available to support the costs used to assess the reuse of Parcel P at the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant and the feasibility of pursuing any of the reuses identified. These funds shall be made available through 2027. So I run the business development shop over at GoBiz, which consists of the California Business Investment Services team, which focuses on site selection, incentive navigation, and landing and attracting new businesses to California or expanding existing operations in California. I also run the Office of Permit Assistance, which does direct engagement with businesses and permitting authorities across the federal, state, and local landscape to assist them with potential needs or issues. And then also a team called the Community and Place-Based Solutions team, which works with local governments and the federal government in trying to draw down additional state and federal monies to local jurisdictions on community-led projects. And so I've been tasked with utilizing these $5 million to assess the existing information that has been presented by the various studies that have been outlined by previous presenters, including the 2018, the REACH study, and the current one in formation with CNRA. It is our current position. We are still in the formulation of the planning around how we're going to deploy these funds, and we will definitely be seeking additional input from as many stakeholders and reasonable participants as possible. At this current time, we are in the position of really gathering information and attempting to understand how to leverage this information in a way appropriate to achieving the goals that are outlined in many of these plans, but also to test those on a feasibility scale. So in many sense, or in many cases, as was mentioned by one of the panelists previously, there's a lot of interest in potential reuse, but it's been at a more cursory level, and our intent is to get a little bit deeper into the weeds on some of that. So that's my two cents at this point. If there's any particular questions or opportunities for me to gain or give a little more, thank you for doing, that would be great.
Thank you, Kaina. Any questions? Scott.
Yes, I was just trying to get some clarification as far as the dollars, the $5 million. Is that specifically only for Parcel P, or could that be utilized to look at other area-wide economic?
To my knowledge, Parcel P is explicitly carved out.
Any other questions or comments? Bruce.
I just wanted to ask if there's been any discussion about collaborating with universities regarding architectural plans, development plans, repurposing of the facilities that are there. I know Cal Poly's been engaged in that type of project with undergraduate students, and there's a research collaborative that focuses on green tech at the Institute for Climate Leadership and Resilience at Cal Poly that has probably 50 different professors from, you know, every different profession, from engineering to community development, that could be engaged and get their classes engaged on this, a project like this. It would leverage your $5 million significantly.
We don't have any direct plans for what to use the monetization on explicitly, but I would be interested in hearing opportunities where we would leverage it towards those aims. The guiding language that we have is to pursue any reuses identified, which is pretty broad language. So I think that we would have to have those dialogues with those parties just to see what the art of the possible really looks like.
Any other questions or comments? Linda.
Just one question. Thank you for coming. How do you decide who those entities are going to be? Who decides, and how is that done?
So our typical way of awarding funds would be through a public RFP process, which would basically put out a scope of work as to what we're trying to identify or what we're trying to get an answer to. We would be using outside parties. GoBiz as an entity would not be doing the research or the decision-making on our own. We would actually be looking for experts that are able to more cogently describe those opportunities and the feasibility of performing those tasks as identified by the potential reuse documentation.
Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, thank you, Kina, for being with us tonight. Really appreciate it. Next item on the agenda is the PG&E update, and Tom Jones, I think you're going to provide that for us.
Good evening. Tom Jones, Senior Director of Regulatory and Environmental, and I'll spell it too, J-O-N-E-S, but that one should be a home run there. All right, so a quick update here on a couple of things that are going on. One, the 2021 Nuclear Decommissioning Cost Triennial Proceeding is slated to be before the Public Utilities Commission tomorrow for adoption. It is slated to be adopted via the consent calendar right now, so hopefully that just shows you how far the parties have come in terms of settlement and the 30-day period that where the proposed decision was issued. There is an update on the proposed decision. One thing that's come before this panel and that there's been some discussion on is the proposed decision does add, and you might recall my previous testimony to this group, that they always give us a homework assignment, and the homework assignment is public now that the commission is considering, if they adopt tomorrow, requiring PG&E to look at what the cost and environmental impacts would be to pursue a 10 versus a 25 millerandum cleanup standard. Now, they can ask us to look at that, but the cleanup standards and are the exclusive jurisdiction of the NRC. So we'll see if that gets adopted tomorrow, but that will fundamentally change our approach to how we prepare for the application next year. And we have to submit in December of the calendar year. So you might recall, so this upcoming NDTCP, if this one's adopted tomorrow, will give us 13 months to solve that problem and have an application before the commission in December of 2024. So that'll be quite a large undertaking on our part, so we'll see how that goes. There was some other comments tonight about site characterization. It's important to remember that all of the things we talked about, TREOF, decommissioning of Diablo Canyon, and that project drives what's available. But in that process, we have two tiers. The NDTCP I just mentioned, we agreed next year, by the next year's application, to have surveyed and characterized the creek areas. So that will occur and be public when we submit that application in December of next year. You all know Trevor Rebel, he'll be leading that project with some outside consultants to start that work in earnest this fall and then complete it and have it publicly available when we submit the application in 2024. Then after that, the NDTCP will be submitted. We should have some resolution on the permitting path for decommissioning and where we are. And what will come clear into picture at that point is we should have a sufficiency determination from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that will help inform how much longer the plant could operate. So things will become into more focus next year in the first and second quarter. And then as a reminder, going back to the draft environmental impact report, Public comments close next Monday at 5 p.m. And so we'll be submitting our comments as well at that time. And then the county will then adjust their schedule based on the both the volume and the breadth of comments they receive, since they're obligated to respond to them. So we, in conversations with county staff before, they do anticipate that to be in the Q1 or Q2 of 2024 as well. So a lot of moving parts, but you know, we like to think about narrowing and closing out on some of the applications. And so tomorrow, the adoption of the NDTCP, should that be successful by the commission, will give us certainty on our path for the current 3 years on funding and what's expected of the utility in the next application the following year. Okay, so with that, happy to answer any questions that you might have. Patrick.
Yeah, Tom, I'm wondering on
Patrick,
the
can you get a little closer to the mic? I'm having a little trouble here, so I think
I'm sorry. Patrick Demu speaking here. I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on this vote tomorrow on the discussion on whether to go with a 10 MRAM versus 25 MRAM cleanup in terms of cost. And also in terms of consequence to the site.
Sure. So the vote tomorrow is the full Public Utilities Commission votes on budget matters before them of this size, and so the Nuclear Decommissioning Cost Triennial Proceeding, the NDTCP, that's essentially a budget application that the utility submits every 3 years. So tomorrow they should vote it out based that it's on the consent calendar, and it'll have a number of items for us, dozens of things for us to implement in the next application as we move forward. But particularly to this cleanup standard, what it says, and it's a very brief description, the utility is directed to provide an analysis of what the additional environmental impacts for cleanup could be and what those additional costs for consumers could be. It doesn't direct us to achieve that standard, and that is actually the purview of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So we've got a Venn diagram of regulatory overlap here, and so we'll execute that if that's the order that's adopted tomorrow, and that'll become public when we submit in the following year. But think about things like excavation. You know, think about soil composition and site characterization, and how do you achieve those different standards. We've been working toward this 25 millirem standard, which you come in below. You don't design a project to meet the number exactly. And at Humboldt Bay, for instance, we successfully remediated that location. It was authorized in the coastal zone at 25 millirem, and we achieved single-digit numbers on that. So you do aim to come below that, but the threshold that one must meet as a licensee from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is 25 millirem, and that standard is on an annual basis. So that assumes that it's called a resident farmer standard, that the individual lives at the location all 8,760 hours of the year, draws their sustenance from the location, drinks the groundwater from the location, and drinks the milk from the cow that ate the grass that grew in the location, right? It's a very rigorous standard versus an industrial standard or something else. So when you think about the potential future uses, it's also hard to fathom somebody being a resident farmer on parcel P. In fact, it's not zoned for that. And then with that standard, Ms. Seeley asked a question once or twice about who decides about development. As it stands today, that's the County of San Luis Obispo. The County of San Luis Obispo has an approved local coastal program over about two-thirds of that site. And you remember we have that line that shows the coastal boundary and then the area up by the transmission yards and up in that 300-foot elevation. That's the exclusive jurisdiction of the County of San Luis Obispo for planning and building standards. In the coastal zone, they have a local coastal program, and they're in charge of the zoning, and that area is zoned public facilities. And there's a table in the county general code, and it says what you can and can't do there. And then on top of that, any activity there that would be subject to a discretionary permit is subject to appeal to the California Coastal Commission. So some of our projects have been appealed, not all have, but then the Coastal Commission has a couple of options. They can either look at the appeal and say it's not substantive to the Coastal Act. Sometimes there's appeals about building standards and they don't hear them because that's not what their jurisdiction is. So there's two overlays, but again, it's the county planning and building department. The permits can come before either a hearing officer if it's a minor use permit. If it's a larger project, a conditional use project, it typically goes to the Planning Commission, subject to appeal to the Board of Supervisors, and then subject appeal to the Coastal Commission. So permits on larger projects usually see three stops in the hearing process. And they, like this project, if they're of that size, would likely have their own environmental impact report as well, where you'd have the scoping meetings like we had. So there would be years of public participation, and I would suggest no fewer than five opportunities for public comment along the way. But we're not going to be that applicant. We don't build hotels. We don't build universities. That would be a successor entity in that area.
I have one question for you, Tom. You said you're going to do a site characterization of the creek area?
Correct.
What does that mean?
So I'm going to start, and Trevor Rubble's going to finish. So get ready, Trevor. So what we do is we'll actually take sediment samples in the creek beds and look for any radioactive contamination that could be attributed to the operation of the plant. It's likely we won't find anything. What we'll find is more environmental items that could be associated with above grounds weapon testings from the 1950s and 60s, things like that. But Trevor, as soon as he arrives, I'll have him make the next comment or two. And so he's in charge of the methodology for that, and he'll be bringing in the independent resources to help us execute that and procure the laboratories to do the confirmatory analysis on our behalf. That's work PG&E does not do.
And Trevor, maybe you could add, why are you doing this? Because it's a regulatory requirement, or what drives you to do these tests now?
Sure. First, Trevor Rebel, R-E-B-E-L for the record, and the CPUC, in agreement with the NDTCP, said we'd like you to go and characterize, perform a preliminary characterization of Diablo Creek. So what that looks like is we're going to, Bruce mentioned earlier that we did a historical site assessment, which means we look at all the paperwork from the time the plant was built until current. That's just a paperwork drill. And that identifies gaps. He said there's gaps, and there are gaps in there. The purpose of site characterization is to close those gaps and identify, are there problems, where are they? So as part of that process, we agreed with the Public Utilities Commission to go look at Diablo Creek. So we're gonna do a series of samples from where Diablo Creek, where the plant empties into Diablo Creek to the ocean. There'll be 15 to 20 samples there, and we're gonna look for radioactivity, oil contamination, something called polychlorinated biphenyls, a whole host of contaminants that could be there. And we'll send those to an independent lab. We have an independent third party who's going to take a look at all that data and provide us a report. And as Tom mentioned, that report will be made public in the NDTCP in 2024.
And just one thing to add to Ms. Woodruff's question, it was part of the settlement package with all or most parties in the previous NDTCP. So I believe Women's Energy Matters was interested in this area, and I think there was one or two other participants. So as a collective effort to settle the issue, we offered and agreed to do this work. It helps us lean forward a little bit on decommissioning, understand what's there, and I firmly expect negative results on these investigations.
So this, when Bruce mentioned the historical site assessment that has gaps in it, this is going to fill in those gaps, is that what you said?
For that one specific area, yes.
Okay. And then those other gaps that are there, are those just gaps that we'll never know about, or what?
We will know about those, but a formal site characterization will happen after the units cease to operate. When we go to terminate the license, when both units are eventually shut down, whatever year that is, we'll go and do a formal site characterization of the entire Part 50 license, the entire Parcel P area for both radioactive and chemical contamination.
And whatever happened to all the data that I read the historical site characterization, and everywhere you look, it says, oh, data not available, data not available. What happened to the data?
There was never any data there. We never looked.
Oh, okay. Thank
not
you.
Hard look. Yes, sir.
Bruce Severance. So if you didn't have data, what was the reason that the historic site assessment study was written, because it kind of points to all the potential places where you'd want to gather data. Were you required to write that document?
Yes.
Okay. As part of the NRC required it, or this was part of the settlement that you're mentioning with, what was it called, Women in Energy or
Women's
something?
Energy Matters is one of the parties.
Uh-huh. Okay. Was that a lawsuit, or was that just a proceeding at the CPUC?
There's two questions here, Trevor. Why don't you start first with the historical
sure.
site assessment?
So as part of decommissioning planning and a license termination plan, we are required to perform a site characterization study. Prior to the site characterization study, you do like we talked about, a historical site assessment, look at all the paperwork, what are nuclear power plants, what could potentially be there. Everything is listed. And then when we close those gaps, we actually go out and look for everything and identify what's there.
Okay, so the purpose of that document was to identify where the gaps were.
Correct.
Okay.
It's part of a long process, right?
That's really helpful. I've read that, and I don't recall it saying that that's what the purpose of the document was.
It helps inform the scope for the physical interrogation.
I get that now. It just seemed like, you know, I looked at a map of the facility, and there's something called the records warehouse or something like that, and I thought, they got a whole warehouse for records. Certainly they must have this data sitting around. So, no, it's helpful that that's the purpose of the document.
All right, this concludes my remarks. Thank you.
Where's our leader there?
Thank you, Tom and Trevor. It's time for a break, so let's reconvene at 7:50. So that will give us about 13 minutes for a break. Does that make sense? Did I do the math right? Okay. When we come back from the break, the next agenda item is going to be public comment. So for those of you in the room that are here tonight, if you would like to make public comment, there are blue cards over in that basket on the other side of the room. And please fill out a blue card and give it to one of the folks to me or one of the folks in the blue shirts. And we will make sure that you have the opportunity to provide a public comment. For those of you online who would like to make a public comment, please raise your hand, and you can raise your hand right now, and then we'll get an idea of the number of public comments that we have and the time that we have available for each comment. So with that, let's adjourn the meeting until 7:50. back to the Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel, and now is the opportunity for the public to offer comments and observations for the panel. We have about seven or eight people in the audience in person that would like to speak, and we also have four people online that have raised their hands. So I think 3 minutes for a comment. I would like to turn it over to Kara Woodbutt for the public comment section.
Hi, everyone. Looks like we all have 3 minutes to make your presentation tonight, and we very much look forward to your input. Want to remind you, when you take the microphone, please state your name, your city, and your affiliation, if any. Please try to be respectful and be timely. When you get close to your 3 minutes, I'll give you like a 5-second warning. If you could wrap it up so that everybody gets plenty of time to give their 3 minutes, that would be great. So why don't we go ahead and get started, Chet?
Okay, and for the benefit of the court reporter, please spell your name if it's an unusual name. Okay. Our first speaker is Lori Wolf, followed by Gene Nelson. And please use that podium over there.
Okay. Maybe I'm ready to go. I'm Lori Wolf, W-O-L-F, just like the beast. I'm a board member of the Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. There have been a number of study sessions and meetings since the draft environmental impact report for the decommissioning of Diablo Canyon has been circulated for comment. The comment period closes Monday, the 25th of September, and be sure that your comments are made through the county planning to be being part of the record that must be responded to. One comment we can all add to any other individual concerns is that County of San Luis Obispo does have the authority as the issuer of the development plan, the coastal development permit, and the conditional use permit to condition approval of on-site remediation to the best practices level of not to exceed 10 millirem, the same tighter standards that were accepted by the NRC in Maine, Vermont, Massachusetts, and New York for their site cleanup standards. There is no federal preemption to prevent the county from taking this step, as the transcripts and sworn testimony in the CPUC decommissioning proceeding Mr. Jones mentioned previously attests to. Phrasing is important, and it was somewhat misleading what we heard tonight. The county can say 10 millirem cleanup standard. This engagement panel can recommend 10 millirem standard as an alternative and a condition for any local or state approval for decommissioning standards. We deserve it, and I hope you make that recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Gene Nelson, you're up.
And the next speaker after Gene is David Wiseman.
Good evening, panel. My name is Dr. Gene Nelson. That's Nelson like the Admiral. And I'm the president and senior legal researcher for a pro-Diablo Canyon organization called Californians for Green Nuclear Power. And my comments tonight really are explained in the first sentence. The Diablo Canyon Decommissioning Engagement Panel is acting prematurely, particularly in light of the passage and the enactment of SB 846 last year on September 2nd, 2022. SB 846 preserves the option of extended Diablo Canyon operations at least until 2030. Diablo Canyon's benefits include the safe, abundant, reliable, cost-effective, and zero-emission generation of a huge amount of power. Diablo Canyon generates the equivalent of 5 Hoover dams of electricity each year. And that's in a compact facility. You really don't get that until you've been there and see how small it really is. We've been hearing a lot tonight about millions of dollars from the state or whatever. Diablo Canyon pumps in around a billion, not a million, but $1 billion in regional economic benefits each year, in addition to that huge amount of power. Those benefits will disappear if Diablo Canyon is closed. I'm sure these were some of the reasons why the legislature and the governor enacted SB 846 last year. Now, I've worked briefly at the plant. I've visited many times, and it's a high security facility. Any encroachment of Parcel P would not be safe or wise. The best and highest use of Diablo Canyon lands would be to keep Diablo Canyon running. Thank you.
Can you hold your response to the end? Is that okay, Patrick? Okay, great. And next up is David Weissman.
And following David is Jennifer Haft.
Good evening, panel. David Weissman, Legislative Director, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility. And indeed, just to clarify the issue regarding preemption of this issue, in the Public Utilities Commission case that Mr. Jones mentioned today, PG&E corrected its written testimony and acknowledged under oath that the federal preemption of radiological cleanup standards for the NRC licensed sites only applies, quote, until termination of the Part 50 operating license, with the unquote. With the testimony so corrected, PG&E's witness acknowledged agreement under oath with the California Coastal Commission jurisdictional finding for the coastal development permit regarding the Humboldt Bay nuclear decommissioning, quote, the state has jurisdiction over post-license conditions, including those related to radiological concerns, end quote. So I hope that clarifies the statement regarding what is and isn't preempted. In this case, it is not. Now, that said, what you are looking further to do then is discuss the redevelopment of Parcel P. And the question is, well, what type of a site would folks be looking to possibly redevelop? Would it be the cleanest and most attractive site to potential development? To that end, PG&E submitted to Susan Strachan of the County Planning in December of 2021, as it says here, enclosed is the Diablo Canyon Power Plant Site Repurposing and Reuse Concepts Report. And it goes on to say, the land use concepts presented in the enclosed report may assist potential future successor entities interested in reuse of the site by providing information on potential opportunities and drawbacks of each potential land use. Quote, end quote. That was sent by Mr. Jones. And if you go inside to the table of opportunities and constraints, under constraints you find radiological and chemical contamination, with the bullet point noting perceived contamination of the site by the public may result in resistance to certain uses. So that bodes well for portends well that you should put out to the public the best possible site in terms of its cleanliness to attract potential reuse. And indeed, in the Humboldt Bay decision, the Public Utilities Commission acknowledged in their decision, quote, the uncertainty and find some merit in PG&E's efforts to assess and incorporate an expectation of regulatory and public tendency towards higher standards of site cleanup. As more nuclear facilities begin decommissioning, we anticipate efforts to reduce the confusion and improve coordination of state and federal regulations. We also think the public and regulatory interest is heightened and reasonably likely to lead to lower acceptable limits for residual radiological contamination in the future. So between the past Public Utilities decisions, the current case, and their own report on redevelopment, I think you see the evidence there that it is worth considering the stronger standard, and you can recommend that. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And I think next up is Jennifer Heff. Is that what you said?
And Jennifer will be followed by Kelly Thomas.
Good evening, Jen Haft. It's H-A-F as in Frank, T as in Tom, San Luis Obispo, and I'm with Cal Poly. Good evening. My name is Jen Haft, and I serve as the Interim Chief of Staff to Cal Poly President Jeffrey Armstrong. He regrets that he could not be here this evening. We appreciate your interest in the future of Diablo Canyon. Diablo Canyon represents approximately 12,000 acres of coastal land and contains many sites and landscapes of historical and cultural significance for the YTT Northern Chumash Tribe of San Luis Obispo County and region. The community unanimously invited Cal Poly to play a leadership role in that future, and we are eager to be true community partners in these efforts. As an institution with experience in conservation projects and leadership in regional economic development, the university has been working closely with key partners, including REACH, YTT Northern Chumash, and the Land Conservancy of Slo County, for more than 2 years toward the collective goal of delivering substantial long-term benefits to the Central Coast community. One part of this is the desire to see a portion of the important tribal lands returned to the YTT Northern Chumash and a significant portion of the lands placed in conservancy for the long-term benefit of and use by the citizens of San Luis Obispo County and the state. Another goal is to spark economic development and innovation to accelerate climate resilience. With investment assets like the Cal Poly Pier and Tech Park and co-use of Parcel P can collectively foster a clean tech innovation ecosystem, advancing R&D and spurring new companies and jobs in the region. Combined with additional resources and partnerships, this will form the foundation of a new Central Coast hub for renewable energy, marine science, aquaculture, desalination, and emerging technologies. Cal Poly is renowned for its learn-by-doing ethos and contributions to aerospace, marine science, engineering, architecture, agriculture, and beyond. And we are excited by the potential for important contributions in the field of clean tech and climate resilience, and look forward to continuing our work with these important community partners as we explore and refine the possibilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Jennifer. And next up is Kelly, and I didn't hear the last name. Chuck.
And Kelly will be followed by Michael Klaus-Zarat.
Good evening. Kelly Abbas, A-B-B-A-S. I'm a legislative assistant to Supervisor Dawn Ortiz-Legg, and I will be sharing a comment on her behalf tonight as she regrettably also could not be here. Good evening to our state officials and members of the Slo County community. I first want to thank the many volunteers who have participated and to PG&E for managing the Diablo decommissioning panel since 2018. The intention of the Diablo decommissioning panel was to serve as a forum for local community members with a focus on understanding and communicating the areas of interest regarding shutdown and decommissioning. The panel's sole mission was to provide information to the public and receiving public input. These significant efforts have been extremely helpful to our community, even as we look forward to the extension of the plant operations. Tonight, the topic of Diablo lands is pertinent as we, the County of San Luis Obispo, recognize this coming Friday as Native American Day. We will honor the original people of the Americas, their rich culture, and acknowledge the horrific trauma of displacement, diseases, and wars that took place for hundreds of years. As so, these very Diablo lands were tribal homeland to the YTT. In an odd way, due to the location of Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant, the surrounding Diablo lands have been nearly untouched for decades. They are pristine as if time stopped. The land stewardship and management of these lands by PG&E, the investor-owned utility, must also be commended. This land is breathtakingly gorgeous and abundant with many resources. If you look to the north at Montana de Oro State Park, there is a very significant difference in the quality of the land. We love our parks to the point where we must consider all impacts on them. The California Public Utilities Commission Native American policy also acknowledges the importance of returning tribal lands to the original descendants and providing a path to do so in State Resolution E-5076. In addition, we must be mindful of the utility and their need to meet various agency obligations, among other responsibilities as well. So as our community engages in this important discussion, I respectfully ask for consideration of these facts and to honor the work with the YTT's people's wishes and to keep the Diablo lands pristine and limit excessive public access. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Kelly, up next is Michael. Is this an online? Oh, there you go. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. My name is Michael Kuszarate, spelled K-H-U-S hyphen Z-A-R-A-T-E. I'm here representing two Chumash tribal groups that are on the Native American Heritage Commission's MLD and recognized lists, the Coastal Band of the Chumash Nation and the Northern Chumash Tribal Council. So I wish to thank the panel for having this hearing here tonight. I've listened with great interest. And I want to point out that our relationship with Diablo goes back thousands of years, but more recently, I can attest to this personally, that it was our tribal representatives who were there when the plant was being built, and some 13 ancestors of ours were removed in the plant footprint for that plant to be built there. We had to go ahead and witness that and rebury those ancestors. So our relationship with the plant goes back to when it, even before it even started. In more recent years, we've held ceremony there, winter solstice ceremony, according to our traditions. And as those included various members of other various tribal groups, not just our own. No single tribal group can or should monopolize or, assume that they can speak for all of us. I don't think that anyone in the United States of America would tolerate having one or two representatives for all of the 50 states and all of the 330 million people living in this country. It's the same thing for our tribal groups. It's not our fault that our history has factionalized us. But be it as it may, I would encourage the panel to make sure that you include all of the various tribal groups that have expressed a cultural affiliation to this most precious and beautiful land out there. The Native American Heritage Commission has a term. It's called most likely descendant. And that term is, what it means is that there is, to expedite mitigation for the damage that done to cultural resources and to our sacred sites when they are impacted by development, is to expedite the development of those lands. It's not necessarily to represent us. My point is that most likely descendant does not mean the only likely descendants. We are the other likely descendants of Diablo Canyon. And we have not always been heard by this body. And I regret that. I hope it's remedied. Our position, not that we've been asked, but our position is that we wish to see the conservation of Diablo lands maximized. We want to see public access maximized. That's our position about the reuse of the lands at Diablo Canyon and to keep them as pristine as they have been since time immemorial and since my ancestors walked and lived there. Thank you so much for having me here this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Do we have any other speakers in person tonight?
That's all the cards I have for people who would like to speak here that are in person. We have four speakers that would like to speak online. I'm going to read them all off, and they'll speak in this order. Catherine Phelps, Mona Tucker, Paolo Perrone, and Susan Harvey. Can we hear from Catherine Phelps, please? And especially for the people online, please spell your name and identify your location and affiliation.
Hi, my name is Kathleen Phelps, and I live in Aurora Grande, and I'm with Backcountry Horsemen of California, the Los Padres unit. And I have two comments. One had to do with any dispersals of the Diablo land, And I noticed on your map early on in the presentation that the North Ranch has scattered land parcels that are north of and within the Cherry Canyon Ranch. And these isolated, this makes for some isolated and peninsula-type parcels going into the what would become state land if the recommendations go through. And they'll be of other ownership. And I was a land manager, and it makes it very difficult to do comprehensive land management when there's little pieces of other ownership within a large mass of land. So I'd suggest that you consider taking those isolated and peninsula parcels in that North Ranch that are inland and putting them in with the massive amount of the Cherry Canyon Ranch land, you know, so that it's consistent ownership from Montana de Oro south. It'll just make management a lot easier, especially for any kind of trails that are being created. And then my other comment has to do with the trails, and I just encourage that both the coastal and the inland trail that's being considered include equestrian use as well as hikers or mountain bikers. Thank you very much. Oh, and you spell my Phelps like Michael Phelps.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is Mona Tucker. Go ahead, Mona.
Good evening. My name is Mona Tucker, T-U-C-K-E-R, and I'm calling from Arroyo Grande. That's where I live. I'm the tribal chair of the YTT, Northern Chumash Tribe, and Chumash is spelled C-H-U-M-A-S-H. And as always, I'm only speaking for my tribe. The members of my tribe are documented as the appropriate historical pre-colonization first people of Diablo lands. We were removed forcibly from our land, and many died as a result. This was done without our agreement, consideration, or compensation. The people who are buried on Diablo lands are my relatives. We have been working for years to reacquire our land, and that work continues. We're excited to see these funds and their stated purposes, as they are in alignment with a proposal that our tribe, along with Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County, Cal Poly, SLO, and REACH, presented to the CNRA. We are in favor of economic development on Parcel P, but I want to say more about that and to answer an earlier question, and that's that our tribal council and tribal members are opposed to a casino. However, I can't speak for any other tribes or Native groups, and I don't know their current or future intentions. We are in favor of managed public access, but with consideration for tribal values, places of cultural sensitivity, ceremonial places, cemeteries, and cultural landscapes. The tribe is also committed to the careful planning to protect important plant and animal habitats, including offshore habitats for the ocean people. So I'll close by saying we're looking forward to engaging with the research and the reports, and to say thank you to the engagement panel and to all the presenters. This concludes my comments.
Great. Thank you, Mona. Our next speaker is Paolo Perrone. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Paolo Perrone, and I'm calling in from Ventura, and I'm with the Nature Conservancy. And first, I just want to thank the panel, LeQuinn with CNRA, the Coastal Conservancy, and particularly Assemblymember Addis and Senator Laird for their leadership on this particular issue. We're curious if there are specific outcomes or documents that the Coastal Conservancy hopes to produce with the budget allocation. You know, there's ecological, indigenous, and recreational outcomes that I think were pointed to in all of those plans, and I think we're all hoping for. And we're also looking to see if there's a timeline to produce those particular documents. So a little bit of a question, but, you know, hopefully we'll just find out where those answers come in time. And I do just want to thank everybody, and it's encouraging to have so many thoughtful folks working on this truly generational project. So thank you.
Thank you. Our last speaker is Susan Harvey. Go ahead, Susan. Susan, we're not hearing you. You may have to unmute your microphone.
Thank you so much. I'm so sorry. Oh. It was like a big sign saying unmute. Thank you, Chuck.
You bet. Go ahead.
Susan Harvey, H-A-R-V-E-Y. I live in the Creston area. I represent the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to speak this evening. We support the Friends of Diablo Canyon report that was issued a few years ago. We support a conservation being placed on the land before the land ownership is transferred. We support management by a coalition of state, nonprofit, and a plurality of tribal interests. The easement should include public access, the best practices management for preservation of habitat, species, and archaeological resources. I think that about covers it, and I want to thank you all again for your time.
Thank you. That's all the online speakers that have raised their hands. So go ahead, Kara.
Is there anyone here or online that would still like to speak tonight? Okay, hearing nothing, I think I'll turn it over to the panel if they have any comments. But I think before we, with the panel, it sounds like there's an outstanding question for the State Coastal Conservancy. Trish, I don't know if you heard what the TNC representative said. Did you want to take a crack at that?
I did hear. What I can say is it's too soon for us to be able to answer that question, but we will happily answer it as we get further into the process. And keeping everybody informed on both what we're planning to produce and a timeline would be a key part of our transparency.
Thank you. And I wanted to respond to the question about coordinated management. Right now, the Diablo Canyon lands and the surrounding Irish Hills have such a complicated ownership pattern. There's land that's owned by PG&E, by Eureka Energy, by State Parks, by the Nature Conservancy, by the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo, by the Bureau of Land Management. No matter what happens, coordination is going to be required, especially you have some new owners, the tribal entities. So I think it's going to be really challenging for this community, but it's clear that there's probably going to have to be some kind of overarching management entity that's comprised of representatives from all these groups, because people may want to hike all the way from Montana de Oro all the way to Avila Beach. And that means they're going to be crossing a lot of different property boundaries along the way. And so one of the major challenges going forward is how do we coordinate all these activities and entities. Did anybody have any other questions or comments they wanted to mention? Bruce?
I wanted to just direct a question to you. And, you know, how practical is the suggestion of doing a land swap or integrating, you know, certain parcels that are island parcels or peninsula parcels and redrawing the map and letting different agencies have jurisdiction over those than may currently have jurisdiction? And does it make a difference if there's an overarching agency that's kind of overseeing how the lands are conserved? So what did you think of the suggestion of addressing the islanded parcels? And I don't think they were islanded within Wild Cherry Canyon. I think the speaker was mistaken about that. I think that they're islanded within what appeared to be Montaña de Oro state lands. So, you know, how do you solve that problem?
So I'm going to say what Trish said. I think it's premature to answer that question. but maybe PG&E could put up online a picture of the map for the Diablo Canyon lands. It was an one of the presentations. It's even on one of my slides. But it's just a very complicated mosaic of lands. And at the end of the day, there won't be just one entity that owns it. There's going to have to be coordination. I mean, just the Diablo Canyon lands alone, if we're contemplating North and South Ranch being owned by a tribal entity and Wild Cherry Canyon being owned by the state or government entity and Montana de Oro's owned by the state, to get from one to the other is going to require coordination. So who knows where this goes, but when the Coastal Conservancy spends its $5 million, a big part of their allocation is for public outreach. And during those public hearings, I think comments, suggestions on how this all works will be welcomed by that entity, because they're going to have to start answering some of these questions.
So another question that somebody raised, and I would like to address to the whole panel for discussion, is whether or not there should be equestrian trail access. And it's, you know, would that negatively impact, for example, sensitive cultural heritage sites? And the answer would be yes. But are there places where that could be allowed, you know, properly indicated with signage, so that there are areas that are less sensitive where equestrian trails could be allowed? I know that in Pismo Preserve, there's certain areas, you know, Ms. Detman is here today and could answer that question, but I believe most of the trails have equestrian access. I walk up there all the time. I really haven't seen horses very often, but you know, is that compatible? And I'd like to address that to Scott, because I think I see him squirming in his chair.
No. I think what this really relates to is having the appropriate time and study completed to make sure that whatever access is in the appropriate locations, and that's going to be a task in itself. Because I recall sitting in on different planning groups, and there's a lot of interest from a lot of different groups that would like to have access, and probably not all of them will get access because it just won't be appropriate. So that's a task that really has to be, take a lot of time and a lot of study to figure out whether or not there is an appropriate spot for that type of activity. I mean, there's people that are bike riders. There's all kinds of different special interest groups that would like to have access, and that all has to be reviewed and studied before. So it's possible, but then again, maybe not.
Well, I'm a mountain biker, so I would like to be in on writing that study.
I agree with everything that Scott says on that, and what I would add is that for 20-plus years now, various groups have fought for the conservation of Wild Cherry Canyon, and a big reason there aren't houses on that land today is probably because of the efforts of the equestrian community and the bicycle riding community and the hikers and the botanists and everything else. So there's been a pretty broad-based user group that's been working very actively for a long time to preserve their right to eventually access the land. That said, it has to be compatible with sustainable protection of the property. And I think that's one of the reasons that the consensus has developed towards tribal ownership of North and South Ranch, which tend to be more sensitive, and maybe state ownership of Wild Cherry Canyon, because they're anticipated to have heavier access, more diverse types of access and recreation on Wild Cherry Canyon, whereas North and South Ranch would be more passive recreation, maybe trails that are very carefully sited. So the idea is, at the end of the day, we're going to try to balance all these interests, but everyone won't have access everywhere at all times if we really want to do a good job at protecting the resources for the long run.
Thanks for that input.
Frances Romero has a question. She's online. And then Linda, and then Patrick.
Hello, everyone. I don't know why I've got the feedback, but apologies for that. Frances Romero, F-R-A-N-C-E-S. Romero, R-O-M-E-R-O. I don't have a lot of experience in San Luis Obispo County, and I'm certainly one of the newcomers to this board, but I do have 10 years as a park commissioner with Santa Barbara County Parks Commission. And I would say that having learned from policies that aren't necessarily that good, that all trails be multi-use trails, horses are not compatible with mountain bikes. So I think that you've got plenty of acreage here and that there is room for everyone. But again, you know, if there's going to be dogs, they need to be on leash and it needs to be enforced because of the resources. But certainly I don't see a reason to exclude equestrians given the amount of space that there are. And it would be preferable for them to have their own trail where they're not competing with mountain bikes, which are not compatible with horses. And certainly to be sure that there's adequate trailheads, because that is always a problem no matter where you put a trail, is whether or not you have adequate parking. So that those would be my only comments. But I truly believe that there is room for everybody. And again, not everybody will get everything at the same time. It just doesn't work that way. That's all I have.
Linda?
Thanks,
Kara.
I want to switch the conversation a little bit away from the trails, et cetera, to the residual radiation, because we've been talking about having Cal Poly. When what really struck me tonight was when the person from Cal Poly was speaking about in glowing terms about how this could be accessible to the students of Cal Poly and it would be a wonderful opportunity for them to be there. And I'm thinking it would be, but I don't understand why PG&E can't commit to a 10 millirem cleanup themselves without having to be ordered to do it by a state, by the state legislature. And I know that the NRC's standard is 25 millirem, but being that four other states have accepted this 10 millirem limit, I can't imagine sending my grandson to a place to study at a place that has residual radiation there waiting for him after it's shut down. So I'd like to know from PG&E, why in the world wouldn't you just voluntarily do this?
So, Linda, we've talked about this, and we explained our success we had at Humboldt Bay, Tom's remarks earlier. You know, we planned the project at 25 millirems, which is the federal limit, and we will come in lower than that. And so that's how we've done it, and that's what we've committed to. That's what we've talked about. And I will send my daughters to a Cal Poly by the Sea any day at a 25 millirem standard.
If I can just add the comment to that, my understanding is that the PG&E position on this is that the 25 millirems is a safe level and a safe standard set by the NRC. However, I'm going to say from just a business and economic viability standpoint, if you're inviting students and business people to come to the site to create an incubator, they're going to be eating their lunches by the creek or doing walking around the property. It certainly creates a more inviting atmosphere if the higher standard has been met. And there are going to be monies saved by not destroying everything and greenfielding the entire property. So there should be the ability to do that and still save money. So I kind of agree with Linda. It's not just about what is a safe standard, it's the perceived safe standard and whether or not you'd want to send your kid to a facility that has, you know, what might appear to be safe to the NRC may not be perceived to be safe by a parent. I've got college-age kids, you know. It becomes questionable for the public. So just because that is questionable, it reduces the value of the property for its repurposing, I think, significantly, to have, you know, 2.5 times higher standard than what has been achieved elsewhere. So, you know, I think why not shoot for the higher standard? You know, even if it's with, as a guideline or within certain, you know, parameters for, you know, you come across technical difficulties achieving that higher standard across the entire parcel P, there would be some mitigation for that or an allowance for that. I just think it makes sense from a business standpoint to shoot for that higher standard.
Thanks, Bruce.
That's my 2 cents.
I think Patrick had some comments as well.
Yeah, thank you. I have comments on 2 separate topics, but I'll start with this one because that came up at the EIR meeting last month as well. It's clearly one that the community as a whole is very concerned with, and so I gave it a little bit of thought and talked to a radiologist who used to be on this panel up until last year as well to get a better feel for what this even means, millirems. This is not a quantity that we talk about every day. So apparently Humboldt was decommissioned to a 9 millirem level is what I heard. And this is now becoming the gold standard. So for those who are concerned, I say, well, why stop there? Let's just ask PG&E to remediate it to zero, right? Nothing's better than zero. But I think intuitively we understand that the cost of doing this would be prohibitive. In fact, the cost to remediate to a lower and lower level grows exponentially. So by the time you get to zero, it would be, you know, an incredible cost. And I don't think PG&E is footing that bill. We are. The ratepayers are going to end up paying for this remediation. So at some point, we have to make a decision. Well, what are we willing to pay for what level of remediation? And so I looked this up, and the amount of radiation that you get from a transatlantic flight back and forth is about 10 millirem. But you don't hear the airlines warning you and explaining to you that this is a life-threatening danger. And so that, to me, put on perspective what 10 millirem is. So they say remediating PG&E to 25 millirem of exposure per year, and Mr. Jones explained to us that level of radiation is for a person who spends the entire year living on that site, the increased amount of radiation they'd be exposed to. And so when I compare that to the transatlantic flight, it does not appear to me as being a dramatic increase in radiation level to a person. And the radiologist that I spoke to before seemed to agree with that interpretation. So I'm not advocating that we stop talking about it, but I really think there has to be a cost-benefit analysis to this discussion at some point as well. I don't know what the cost of remediating to 25 millirem versus 10 is, and I would like to have more information on that, certainly. If it works out to be a penny a month per ratepayer, I say let's go for it. That's money well spent. But if it ends up being $20 per month per ratepayer, I'm not sure that difference makes sense from the consequence level of that difference. Again, this is my opinion, and I think it's worth having a longer discussion about the concept. The second point I would like to make about a different one is on the scope of decommissioning. And one of the comments that was made today is, well, you know, decommissioning has now been put on the back burner because of SB 846, and so therefore our role is a little bit made somewhat more irrelevant. But my understanding is that this extension is for parcel P, And the rest of the decommissioning for the North Ranch and all these other parcels that we're talking about is still proceeding according to the original plan. And please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong on this, meaning that the role of the plan of the vision is still very relevant, and so that would be the decommissioning engagement panel still has an important function to play. That's my comment.
Thank you, Patrick. Any other comments from the panel? I think that wraps up this section. I would just add one little note. I think we're at a really interesting time in this county's history. Not only are we contemplating the conservation of 12,000 acres, but we're also contemplating the potential designation of the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary. And if we play our cards right and all stay engaged, we have the opportunity to do some really amazing conservation work for ourselves and future generations, and that's pretty cool. Thank you.
Thank you, Kara. Our next agenda item is a discussion of the next panel meeting on December 13th of this year, and Linda Seeley is going to lead that discussion.
Thanks, Chuck. Our next meeting is going to be on December 13th, which is also a Wednesday. It's going to be about spent fuel. We have a lot of moving parts in the whole spent fuel question, partially because of the possible extension of the license at Diablo Canyon. But they're also because we have a PG&E ordered a new system for spent fuel, the Orano system, but now they're ordering another 12 Holtec casks, our canisters, to be delivered soon, and we will by that time hopefully we'll know about those deliveries and so on, and then we'll be talking about the plans for the interim fuel storage sites that are on the kibosh in New Mexico and Texas for now, and then we'll also talk about a permanent repository site for spent nuclear fuel, which doesn't exist. So it'll be a very interesting meeting, I think, because as Patrick said earlier, I think we're going to have to look at the Diablo Canyon site as a possible permanent site for into many years into the future, based on current policies and decisions that have been made.
Thank you, Linda. I want to remind everyone that a recording of this meeting will be available on the panel's website, DiabloCanyonPanel.org, along with a transcript in about 3 weeks. We also have all the slides that were used for tonight will be posted probably tomorrow. And all the resource materials, such as the conservation plan from the Natural Resources Agency, are also available on the website. I want to turn it back over to Scott for any closing comments, thoughts.
I get the closing comments, right? Well, I appreciate that. I just would like to thank everyone that participated tonight. This whole subject matter of land, Diablo Canyon land, is a really big deal in our community. We hope that people will stay engaged as far as the process going forward. Just would like to offer up to the panel if there's any other last thoughts or comments before we close it out. If not, I just would like to acknowledge a few people that helped put this program on tonight. Members of the public for attending and providing comments, we really appreciate that. Speaker for their time and presentation, primarily from the state, and of course panel members, we appreciate that greatly. And San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors for the facilities. Also County Sheriff's Department for providing security this evening. PG&E's Fire Department for being on site for any medical emergencies that might have happened, and staff support for the meeting. There's a lot of work on the backside to make this meeting happen, so we really appreciate that. And then the Independent Living Resource Center for Hearing Impaired, and also AGP Video. for managing the Zoom meeting portion of the night. And imagine recording for preparing the overall meeting transcript. So with that, we'd just like to say, whoops, one more.
I'm sorry. I have a question for you, Scott, and that is, I'm not sure, but it appears that there may be conflicting claims to tribal, you know, heritage at the site. I don't know if perhaps I misunderstood that or if there were more than one tribe at the site previously. So the question I have is there a tribal council that would facilitate that discussion and resolve any potential conflicts that might exist between different tribes? And I agree that anybody that wants to have a voice should attend these meetings. I don't think that anybody on this panel is intending to ignore any member of the public that has the right to speak, but maybe you could address that question, because I think all of us are fairly naive to how that works.
You know, that's a very important question as far as how do you determine the appropriate tribal group of any entity or any territory. What's very interesting to me is that our group, the YTT Northern Chumash, is the only documented group that can actually validate where their origins from, meaning actual village sites. And that is what our claim is to that overall area. We truly believe we are the appropriate tribe to do consulting. Most of the time when you take a look at the Native American Heritage Commission, they're talking about most likely descendants. We would say we are the descendants of this particular area. Also, we would say that the state of California, through SB 18 and AB 52, there is an obligation of different permitting agencies to deal with the appropriate tribe. In the event that there is not an appropriate tribe, simply because of being dispersed throughout the state because of what has happened to Native groups, there is an opportunity to default to the list in order to have that consultation. And so as far as the question, well, is there a big council in the sky that will make these determinations? The answer is no. We consider ourselves a sovereign nation, and the decisions are based on our sovereignty, if you will. And so that's our claim as far as that overall area.
So if there's no agency or organization that can facilitate that discussion, how would you suggest that discussion is facilitated?
Well, again, currently right now, especially the latest bill that was passed, that's SB 846, it's specifically noted in the CPUC process that they're supposed to work with the appropriate tribe. Now, that would leave it up to the CPUC to determine who is the appropriate tribe. What I would say is that in 2018, the triennial 2018, the CPUC already required PG&E to make a determination, and a report, the Johnson report, was submitted. And so we believe they've already done that, but other agencies, maybe they're not thinking the same, and that would have to be dealt with.
Okay, thanks.
Uh-huh.
Okay, thank you, panel, and everyone who participated tonight, and we'll consider this meeting adjourned. Thank you.